Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Existence of God, Part 15. And for more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, last week we launched into our discussion of the argument for design based upon the fine-tuning of the universe. And we saw that from its very inception, the universe has been fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life. Fine-tuning does not mean designed. Fine-tuning, as I explained, means that the range of the fundamental constants and quantities that describe the universe must fall into an extraordinarily narrow life-permitting range if intelligent life is to exist. These constants and quantities could take any of a wide range of values. But in fact, unless they all fall into this unfathomably narrow life-permitting range, life would be impossible and would not exist anywhere in the universe. Now, someone asked me last week, when does something become so improbable that it becomes impossible? And I answered that question from memory by saying that William Dembski had set a probability bound of 10 to the 80th power, which is the number of subatomic particles in the universe. Checking, however, Dembski's book, The Design Inference, I see that I had a memory lapse there, and therefore I need to correct this. You don't consider simply the number of particles in the universe. You also need to consider the number of seconds in the universe, which he generously places at 10 to the 25, so that you would consider those states of the universe all through its history. And then he multiplies this times 10 to the 45 as the number of events or reactions that could take place per second. And on this basis, he arrives at a probability bound, which is 1/2 times 1 out of 10 to the 150th power. And anything that falls beyond that probability bound, he says, is not different from impossibility. So that would be an answer to that question about when does something become so improbable as to become impossible. Dembski's probability bound is 1/2 times 1 out of 10 to the 150th power. Dennis? Well, that's a generally accepted figure, that there are around 10 to the 80th. I mean, it's obviously an approximation. And then the same with the number of seconds in the history of the universe. That's given the age of the Big Bang. So these are not really controversial figures, but he's the only person I know of who addresses the question that was put to me last week. And so I simply give you his answer. I'm not a mathematician, so I don't know whether this is the best answer or not, but this is an answer given by a prominent design theorist to that question. I don't think anything in the argument depends upon it, because what the argument is that, well, as we'll see, is that design is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe. We're not going to argue that it's so improbable that it's impossible. Ours is going to be an argument for the best explanation, and we'll look at the alternative explanations for the fine-tuning, and I'll argue that the best explanation is that it was due to design. All right, well, now some people will object to an argument of this sort by saying, well, if the universe had different laws of nature, then maybe a change in the constants and the quantities wouldn't be so disastrous. Maybe if there were different laws of nature, then the universe wouldn't be fine-tuned for life, and you might not have these sort of disastrous results from changing them. But this objection, I think, displays a misunderstanding of the argument that is very, very common, and so I want to correct it. In the fine-tuning argument, we are not concerned with universes governed by different laws of nature. We don't have any idea of what universes would be like that are governed by wholly different laws of nature. That's pure speculation. Rather, what we're concerned with in this argument is universes that are governed by the same laws of nature, but with different values of the constants or the fundamental quantities. The laws are the same, but you alter the value of the constants or the quantities of the universe. John Leslie is a Canadian philosopher who gives an excellent illustration of this point. Leslie says, imagine a solitary fly resting on a large blank area of the wall. And he says, suppose a single random shot is fired and the bullet pierces the fly and kills it. Now, even if outside the blank area the wall were covered with flies so that a randomly fired bullet would probably strike a fly, nevertheless, it still remains highly improbable that within the large blank area a randomly fired bullet would strike the fly. It is vastly more probable that the bullet would hit someplace else in the blank area. And so if the shot does strike the fly, then it's probable that that was not the result of chance, but it was in fact aimed. The fly was targeted by the shooter, and that's why the bullet struck the fly, not by chance, but by design. Now, in exactly the same way, let our universe be like the fly, and this large blank area will be other possible universes described by the same laws of nature as ours, but with different values of the constants and quantities. And what you find is they're all life prohibiting. Even if there are universes outside which are governed by different laws of nature, and in those there is not the sort of fine-tuning that our universe exhibits, nevertheless, the probabilities would still be that a universe governed by our laws of nature ought to be life-prohibiting rather than life-permitting. So, we only need to be concerned with universes governed by the same laws of nature in this argument. And we do not look at and are unconcerned about what would take place in universes that are governed by different laws of nature. Any question or comment about this objection and its answer? Jonathan?
Yes, sir.
Right.
I was just curious about the argument that given enough time with enough, or sufficient time with sufficient universes out there, eventually this would roll out.
Now, here we're only talking about there being one universe. These others are just possibilities. It's not that they actually exist. We'll see that in order to defend the hypothesis of chance, its defenders have been forced to resort to the many universes hypothesis, that there is an infinite number of parallel worlds, other universes, so that by chance alone, the constants and quantities would fall into the life-permitting range in some of them. And we'll deal with that later on, but that's further down the line. Right now, we're talking just about one universe. Okay, Steve.
Yeah, you say the parameters that we're talking about are what define the laws of the universe. And so you're talking about within similar is in the circle?
No, they don't define the laws of the universe, Steve. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Remember, I gave the example of Newton's gravitational law. You could have universes governed by that same law, but with a different value for the gravitational constant. Governed by different laws would be one that where you had a different equation. Say, instead of multiplying the two masses together, you would subtract them from each other, or something of that sort. Rather than dividing by the distance between them, you would multiply by it. That would be a different law of nature. What we're talking about here are universes that have the same laws, but the values of these constants and quantities are different. Okay, any other question about that first point? All right, then, the question that we're facing is, what is the best explanation of this cosmic fine-tuning? And an increasing number of astronomers and scientists think that the best reason for the fine-tuning of the universe for life is that the universe was designed to be life-permitting. But design is not the only alternative. There's also physical necessity and chance. So on your handout, you have a simple form of the design argument stated in terms of those three alternatives. And if anybody needs an outline for this, go ahead and raise your hand and Marion will distribute to you an outline of the design argument. It's very simple in its fundamental structure. It goes like this. Premise one, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. The fine-tuning is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Two, it is not due to physical necessity or chance. Three, therefore, it is due to design. Now, this is a logically valid argument. That is to say, if the two premises are true, then the conclusion necessarily follows. So, the only question is, are those two premises more plausibly true than false? So, before we look at them, does anyone have any question about the structure of the argument that we've laid out? Very simple, easy to memorize argument, but I want to be sure you understand the structure of it before we look at the support for its premises. Yes, Ted, and we would get, well, we'll put it on the mic anyway. Go ahead.
Thank you. Since we haven't been able to get here for a couple of weeks, the first one under due to law, briefly, what is law if it doesn't take too long to explain what that is? I understand the chance
now?
And design.
Oh.
The law. I understand design and chance, but what exactly is law?
The idea there is that the universe is physically necessary that these constants and quantities have the value they do. It's kind of what Steve was saying in a way, that the laws of nature determine that these constants and quantities have the value they do, that this is physically necessary
for them to exist.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. That really there isn't any other kind of physical universe possible. It had to be this way. That's what physical necessity means.
Right, but they do not exist because of a, I thought it was some, maybe you're saying there's some kind of just law out here, like this law generated the creation of this stuff. That's not what you're saying.
No, that isn't what I meant. That's okay, a good clarification. What I meant was simply that the values and the quantities are physically necessary. They couldn't have been any other way. The universe had to be like this. All right, any other question about the structure of the argument before we look at it in detail? All right, take the first premise, that the fine-tuning of the universe is due either to physical necessity, chance, or design. Now, this premise simply lists the three alternatives that are available for explaining the fine-tuning, and therefore this is uncontroversial. Now, if somebody has a fourth alternative, they're welcome to add it to the list, and then we'll have to consider that when we come to premise two. But I don't know of any other alternative than these three, physical necessity, chance, or design. And therefore, the first premise does seem to be true. It simply lists the possible explanations for this extraordinary fine-tuning. Now, notice that by focusing on the fine-tuning, this argument does an end run around the whole emotionally loaded question of biological evolution and Darwin's theory of biological complexity. The argument from fine-tuning, if it goes through, will show that even if life is the product of random mutation and natural selection of a blind evolutionary process, nevertheless, even that still depends upon these finely tuned initial conditions of the universe, which cry out for some sort of cosmic intelligent designer, so that you can just do an end run around all of the negative emotions and baggage that are connected with the creation evolution controversy that exists in biology. Any design arguments that you do want to construct on the basis of things like the origin of life or the origin of mind or the development of biological complexity will simply layer on more improbability on top of the fine-tuning, which will just make the design argument all the stronger, and will show that it is all the more improbable that life and consciousness can be explained apart from a cosmic designer. Any comments then about premise one? Okay, well then that means that the really crucial premise in this argument is the second one, that the fine-tuning is not due to physical necessity or chance. So let's examine each of these alternatives one at a time. First, let's talk about physical necessity. Now, as I just explained, according to this alternative, the universe has to be life-permitting. The constants and the quantities had to have the values that they do, so that it is literally physically impossible for the universe to be life-prohibiting. It is physically necessary that the universe be a life-permitting universe. Well, on the very face of it, this is an extraordinarily implausible explanation of the fine-tuning. It would require us to say that a life-prohibiting universe is physically impossible, that such a thing could not exist. And that is an extremely radical view. Why take such a radical position? The constants, as we've seen, are not determined by the laws of nature. Nature's laws could hold, and the constants could take any of a wide range of values. So there's nothing about the laws of nature that require the constants to have the values they do. And as for the arbitrary quantities, well, remember, those are completely independent of the laws of nature. They're just put in as initial conditions on which the laws of nature then operate. So that nothing seems to make these quantities necessary in the values they have. So the opponent of design here is taking a very radical line, which would require some sort of evidence, some sort of proof. But there isn't any proof that these constants and quantities are physically necessary. This alternative is just put forth as a bare possibility, and possibilities come cheap. What we're looking for here is probabilities or plausibilities, and there just isn't any evidence that the constants and quantities are physically necessary in the way that this alternative imagines. Now, sometimes scientists do talk about an undiscovered or yet to be discovered theory of everything, or as it's abbreviated, a TOE, a theory of everything. And this would supposedly explain everything. But like so many of the colorful names which are often given to scientific theories, this label is very misleading. The purpose of a successful TOE is to unify the basic four forces of nature, which is gravity, electromagnetism, the so-called strong force in the atomic nucleus, and the so-called weak force in the atomic nucleus. And these four forces, according to a theory of everything, will be unified into one fundamental force, which is carried by one fundamental particle. But a theory of everything which manages to unify these four forces of physics obviously doesn't explain everything. The idea that this is a theory of everything is just a misunderstanding. This is just a colorful name which doesn't purport to explain everything at all. It just seeks to unify these four fundamental forces of nature into one force. Indeed, the most promising candidate for a TOE to date, which is so-called M theory, which is a superstring theory. Instead of thinking of the fundamental bearers of these forces as little particles, it thinks of them as one-dimensional strings of energy. And according to M theory, or superstring theory, there have to exist exactly 11 dimensions, 10 dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Otherwise, the theory won't work. There have to be exactly 11 dimensions. But M-theory itself doesn't explain why there are 11 dimensions. That remains just sort of a basic assumption of the theory. It doesn't do anything to explain why that particular number of dimensions should exist. So even M-theory involves fine-tuning of a geometrical sort. Namely, there has to be exactly 11 dimensions in order for the theory to work. So you can see, I think, that this so-called theory of everything that scientists are on the pursuit of isn't literally an attempt to explain everything. Indeed, the best candidates for it have certain unexplained features of it itself. Moreover, M-theory doesn't explain or predict, rather, M-theory doesn't predict a life-permitting universe. In fact, it's been shown that M-theory permits around 10 to the 500th power different possible universes, which are all consistent with the same laws of nature, but which would vary in their fundamental constants. And almost all of these possible universes in this range are life prohibiting. The values of the constants would be such that life could not exist in those worlds. This has come to be called the cosmic landscape. And the cosmic landscape has become something of a phenom in its own right in recent years. And I think it's important to understand that this cosmic landscape of 10 to the 500th power, different possible universes, is not real. These aren't real universes. This is just a description of the range of possibilities. It's the range of values that these constants could take allowed by M-theory. And some people have misinterpreted the cosmic landscape to mean that these different universes actually exist, that they're really out there. And they thought that thereby the argument for design is undermined by the cosmic landscape, because some of these 10 to the 500th power worlds will be life-permitting. And therefore, there have to be life-permitting universes like ours in the cosmic landscape. But you got to keep in mind, the cosmic landscape isn't real. It's just a range of possibilities. It just describes the range of values that M-theory allows for all of these different constants of nature. It describes the range of possible universes that are consistent with M-theory. And so far from undermining the argument from fine-tuning for a designer, it actually reinforces the argument by showing that a life-permitting universe is not physically necessary. In fact, the range is so huge, 10 to the 500th power, that some explanation is required for why, out of this vast range of universes, a life-permitting universe should exist. The life-permitting universes are just an infinitesimal part of the landscape. So that, like that solitary fly on the wall that Leslie talks about, a randomly fired shot would probably hit a life-prohibiting universe, not a life-permitting universe. So you can't say that a life-permitting universe like ours is physically necessary, because at least according to the best theories of physics that we've got today, that's simply not true. That is clearly false. The values of the constants are not determined by fundamental physical theory. Fundamental physical theory is consistent with a vast, vast range of values for those constants, all but an infinitesimal portion of which are life prohibiting. So there's really no evidence at all to support this first alternative, that the fine-tuning is due to physical necessity. The best evidence indicates that it is far from physically necessary that these constants and quantities should have the values that they do. Now, is there any comment or question about that first alternative on physical necessity? Yes, back here in the way. Let's get it on the mic here.
Does M-theory predict how many different membranes do exist that are real? not just that are possibilities?
Now, there you're talking about how many actual universes there would be. And I don't know whether or not that theory is consistent with just any number of actual three-dimensional membranes.
So theoretically it could be infinite or something near there.
Yes. And we'll talk about this when we get to the many worlds hypothesis. I mean, both the question that was here earlier and now this question is pushing us ahead to talk about the chance hypothesis. And the defenders of chance will say that given the reality of these many, many other worlds, these other universes, membranes or other bubble universes, an inflationary universe, that by chance alone, somewhere in this multiverse or world ensemble, there will appear these finely tuned universes. And we're going to deal with that question later when we get to the alternative of chance. But it's important to understand that here we're not talking here about chance. We're talking here about physical necessity. And scarcely anyone defends physical necessity. There are certainly lots of theorists who want to, because many of them feel very uncomfortable with these appeals to the multiverse of the world ensemble. It seems to be smuggling in metaphysics. But on the other hand, the prospects for physical necessity just are extremely dim. So hang on to the question about the other universes. We will get to it. Yes, Ted.
Dr. Craig, this 10 to 500, that's 10, that's one with 500 zeros attached. That's what that
right.
Is that correct? Which
yes.
Is minuscule, I mean,
right.
Potential.
Remember, the number of subatomic particles in the universe is only about 10 to the 80th. So this is a number of which we can form no conception
but
whatsoever.
It seems to me like if, you know, if I were a scientist and smart and stuff like that, I would be looking at this number and say, this not very good chance, but I'm going to go with it's not a very good chance. But they still got to use matter and rocks and sticks and stones, something in these galaxies, gases, whatever it is. That still doesn't tell where they came from. They still got to come from somewhere. Even if they've got that, I mean, if you had 10 to 500 planets stuck out somewhere, they still had to originate
right,
somewhere.
Absolutely, Ted. And that was the argument that we looked at before we looked at the fine-tuning argument. Remember, in this series, we're looking at a number of different arguments for God's existence. The first one was the argument from contingency. The next one we spent several weeks on was the argument based on the origin of the universe. But now we're talking about the design argument. And so you're right. You can always go back to the cosmological argument, but we don't need to go back there unless there's some reason to. We can let this argument stand on its own merits for a designer. But you're certainly right to remind us of that. Sure, it's a cumulative case that one is presenting here. We're presenting a cumulative case in which all of these pieces of evidence come together to build a powerful case for a creator and designer of the universe. It's like a lawyer attempting to build a case against the accused, where he will interview many witnesses and bring many pieces of independent data. And if the data are independent, if the witnesses are independent, that makes his case all the more powerful. So that's why I don't want to collapse this argument back onto the cosmological argument. If we can show independent arguments for God, that will make it stronger, our case stronger, than if this one has to fall back on the earlier argument to be sustained. And I don't think it does have to fall back, as I'll argue. Yes, David, Cheryl.
Okay, so you've told us that M-theory still permits at least 10 to the 500 possible universes consistent with our given laws of physics.
Yes.
So clearly M-theory isn't reducing the physical constants to some certain set that they have to be. That's
correct.
Not the case.
Right.
Does it do anything to even take a step in that direction? Do any of these string theories relate some constants in terms of others? Are they all just completely arbitrary?
Well, it does have a delimited range, David, as you can see. I mean, this number isn't infinite. There is a delimited range here of around 10 to the 500. But many people or theorists were hoping that it would enable us to predict these constants, that from the theory, the constants would fall out as a prediction. And what happened instead is that the specific values didn't fall out. It turned out that there's this vast range that are compatible with the theory. And so that's the focus here, is that although it does have a finite range, it's not, it's still so large that the question arises, well then why is this, why do we have these life-permitting values when it's such an infinitesimal part of the cosmic landscape? That's the question. Yes, there's a question back here.
We touched on this a little bit last week, but it would seem like we could take it yet further back, because if any of these things can be represented mathematically, then that's evidence for design. If everything is random and chaotic, be it how many universes or landscape you want to look at, or how wide the landscape, if it's possible to represent anything mathematically in these, this is an evidence for design, because if everything is purely random and chaotic, mathematics is impossible.
This is an independent argument that our brother is offering here, that some have offered based on what's been called the uncanny effectiveness of mathematics. Eugene Wigner, a very famous physicist, often spoke of how uncanny it is that mathematics works. Why is it that someone sitting at his desk should be able to work out these mathematical equations, and lo and behold, the experimental physicists go out and find that it really describes the way the world is? The universe is mathematically structured in such a way that makes that possible. And some have argued for the existence of a kind of supreme mathematical mind which has structured the universe. And I do think that that is a very intriguing argument. I haven't worked on it myself, so I can't comment any further on that, but it is an independent argument from this one that I think is well worth exploring and thinking about. And as I think about the different possibilities of mathematics existing as separate entities or as being simply creations of the human intellect, it does seem that the most satisfying view of mathematics would be that these are reflective of a supreme mind which thinks in these categories and has built a universe on the blueprint of the plan that is in the mind of the cosmic architect. That is a sort of Platonic idea. That's what Plato believed, that God fashioned the world on the pattern of these mathematical ideas. And as Christians, we would say, well, these ideas exist in the mind of God, not independently of God, but as part of the thought of God. And so he's like an architect who has built a universe that reflects this mathematical blueprint that he's imposed on it. And I do think that's a very intriguing argument. But here, we're not concerned with the mathematical structure of reality so much as the fact that out of all the possible universes in this cosmic landscape, what should exist but a life-permitting universe, when the vast, vast probability, inconceivable probability, is that a life-prohibiting universe ought to exist if it is just by chance. All right, we're out of time, so what we will do next Sunday is turn to the alternative of chance, which several have been pressing me on already, because that is where the real debate lies today. The real debate lies with this question of whether the fine-tuning can be explained away simply as a result of chance, or do we need to infer a transcendent cosmic designer for the origin of the world.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.